Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. And today we're going to be talking not just about mind power in the sense of being in control of what you think. We're going to be discussing that to a degree, but we're also going to be coming into a different level of thinking because of my guest today. We're going to be talking about soul power, endurance power, awareness power. Our guest today is Eleanor Vincent. She is a mom that decided to take on the task of writing her personal story about a daughter, a very special person in her life, obviously, and the experiences that she went through and how, because of these experiences, when she put the book together, Swimming with Maya, A Mother's Story, it really shares a journey that she went through. Again, I'm repeating myself, but it's one that she wants to share with you so that perhaps you can become more empowered and aware as an individual. I want to welcome to the airwaves Eleanor Vincent. Eleanor, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donna. What a lovely introduction. I love that phrase, soul power.
Well, I think any one of us, if we have been touched by the adversities of life, realize that we have a choice. Either we are going to grow through those experiences, painful though they may be, or we are going to find ourselves in a prison, literally, of our own making because of the deep pain that sometimes those experiences bring us. And I don't know of anyone that's gone through life that hasn't had this happen to them at one point or another. And they're either enriched by it or they seem to be captured and imprisoned by it. Mm-hmm. Eleanor, your story about your daughter is a very powerful and compelling one. Swimming with Maya probably took you a good deal of time to write out. How long did it take you?
Well, it took 10 years altogether, but because of the circumstances of my daughter's sudden death, I was in a state of shock, I would say really for the first 2 years. So I did start writing immediately, but it was very raw journal writing. Mm-hmm. And I, at that time, was also in a Master of Fine Arts program at Mills College, which is just a wonderful, wonderful healing place. That I still return to and have those feelings of healing. So I had support for beginning drafts of this memoir through workshops and feedback with others. And gradually over time, the story started to take shape. And I would say that about 5 or 6 years into it, I really got serious about creating a book that would be very appealing to readers, so that it became more than just my process of trying to heal. It became an effort at including readers in our story.
Mm-hmm. And that's a very powerful positioning. Now, this isn't just about grief. We're going to be talking about something that most people don't want to talk about, and we'll go into that in a minute. But I want you to share the story about what happened with your daughter, how old she was, and the accident that caused certain situation.
Well, Maya was 19, and she was a very vivacious, outgoing, gifted person. She was about to go to UCLA to study acting. She had been studying acting at the junior college level, and she was one of the few junior college transfers accepted into the UCLA Theater Arts program, which was a huge accomplishment, and she had gone out to celebrate this accomplishment with some friends. She was home on spring break from college, and they went to a very remote field and found there a horse that was unsecured, unfenced, and on a dare, she and another girl got up on the back of this horse, And, of course, the horse was none too pleased with this, and he reared, and Maya and the other girl slid off. Maya slid off second, and because the other girl had hit the ground already, the force of the fall and the height of the horse was such that she hit her head in a critical place and immediately went into a coma. So one of the things about this story that over the years I've really come to see is that my daughter went unconscious instantly. She did not suffer as far as we know. Mm-hmm. And when I think about the various ways one can leave one's body, the way Maya died kind of perfectly fits who she was as a person. She was so risk-taking, and in a good way, but also sometimes in a more dangerous way, obviously, as this story shows. But she was a risk-taker. She was bold, and her passing fits her boldness. So she did not die in the field because of modern technology and because her friends were giving her mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. But she was only breathing once every 2 minutes or so. So her brain was being starved of oxygen, and there was a huge blood clot forming because of the force of the fall, none of which I understood at the time, of course. It took me a long time to really grasp everything that had happened. But a CalSTAR helicopter came out and airlifted her to the John Muir Medical Center in Walnut Creek, where she received amazing care, brain surgery, life support. You know, they pulled out all the stops to try to save her life. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, it became clear that she was never going to recover. And her surgeon came to our family and said, you know, I'm signing the death certificate, and would you consider organ donation? Mm-hmm. So, you know, in that moment, I kind of had a lot of things flash before my mind, including my mother dying of end-stage kidney disease when a kidney transplant could have saved her life, and I said yes. Mm-hmm. And that set in motion a whole train of events, which I relate in Swimming with Maya, because ultimately the transplantation of Maya's organs and tissues helped many dozens of people and saved the lives of four people, and restored sight to two people. So that was a very uplifting outcome from a horrible tragedy, and I write about meeting the man who received her heart and his wife and two children in the book.
Now, when you've covered a lot here, so let's backpedal a little bit. One of the experiences that you found yourself going through was really becoming more aware of your daughter as a person. Also, after her passing, you found that your daughter's presence was often with you. And I know in one part of your book, when it came to picking flowers for your daughter, and you are very clear about your emotional status then, which I think is very important, because I think so many times when we talk about death, this is a word, it's a five-letter word that denotes a lot of images in people's minds. Now, all of us are going to experience it. Nobody is going to be exempt from it. To the best of my knowledge, I haven't found anybody that is. And it is something that there is a fear about. But there are the issues of dealing with anger. There are the issues of not having control. There's the issues of your feeling as a mother, maybe you could have protected your daughter in some way. And the reality was you couldn't, because she mm-hmm. made this decision on her own. And all of these things, and your awareness of her true essence, her true personality, which was quite beautiful, mm-hmm. but also that she was very human. She had made a choice that wasn't a healthy choice. It wasn't a good choice, but yet that was something she was, like you said, a risk taker. But mm-hmm. you felt her presence after she was gone. And that was something
absolutely.
That was very powerful for you. And this is, again, you went through a lot of emotions, people who were not supportive of Maya. You go through all of these portions of experience. And when someone is said or told that the person that they love is just not going to survive, they're really brain dead. They want to take them off of life support system. It's so emotional. And yet, because of what you had gone through with a previous relative and the what the doctor said, you had to make a decision within a very short period of time. And so often that is very difficult. Let's address an issue relative to organ donation. People will say this is cannibalizing somebody. There are people that have certain beliefs that this is unethical. However, this is something that you have dedicated your life to at this point, educating people about organ donation. Let's talk about that moment when you really had to make that decision, because you were the one that made it.
Right. Well, you know, this gets into questions of spirituality, of values, things that are very deep and personal within each person. So I am only speaking from my own personal experience. I don't at all want to tell people how to think about this. I respect everybody's values because those are very deeply held within us. But my value is life above all. And in that moment, I realized that I was being given a chance to help other families not experience what our family was going through, to alleviate suffering, to do something that would be such a blessing for other people, that even though it might mean that my daughter had to go through an incredible operation to have this done, her brain was non-functional. Her heart was still beating because she was on life support. I'll never know how long it would have taken had she been disconnected from support and just died, how long that process would have taken, but I know she could never have recovered. And knowing that, it just gave me somehow the strength to feel that this is what Maya would want. This is what I want. It seemed to me a greater evil to put perfectly healthy, good organs into the ground when other people and their families could be helped or saved because of this decision. And I did have to make the decision very quickly, but it is something I had thought about ahead of time. I had a donor sticker on my own license. Maya did not, but I had talked to her at the time my mother was dying about the fact that I was going to say that I wanted to be an organ donor, and she thought that was a wonderful idea. So I had to just make a decision as her mother on her behalf to do something that would bring about great good for other people. And I believe that it was the right decision. It was a really difficult decision and one that I've wondered over the years about, but I still come down on the side of life and making something really positive and lasting come out of what to me was a senseless accident.
Now, one of the things that you brought up that I want to touch on, and the reason I want to bring it up, is that I know of different people that own care facilities for the elderly. And there was a woman, her name is Janie, and we've known each other for years. And Janie brought up something that was quite interesting, because when people were admitted to the facility, she would talk with them and their families, a beautiful environment, and she would talk with them and say, well, make sure that they had a will, and would go over some very basic things that you need to go over. And she asked the question of this one woman, would you want to be an organ donor? And the woman said, oh, yes. She then asked her the question, would you want to be kept on a life support system? There were a number of questions that were being asked, so I'm just pulling up two excerpts. And the woman said, absolutely not. I do not want to be kept alive on any or during any circumstances. If it's time for me to go, it's time for me to go. And Janie said to her, are you aware that if you want to be an organ donor, you have to be kept on a life support system? And the woman just looked at her. And Janie very patiently explained to this lady how it's very important to keep the life support system going, because you only have a certain window of time for those organs to be removed from the body and then transported to whatever facility can use them. They have to test them and make sure that everything's healthy and up to par. And the woman was surprised. She said, I never thought of that. And Janie said, most people don't know that that life support system has to be kept in place so that those healthy organs can be removed, and it can be the liver, the pancreas, the spleen, the heart, the eyes. All of this can be utilized, but the body has to be kept in a functional patterning. And this woman said, okay, that's fine then. It's so interesting how very few people are aware of that. And I said, my goodness, Janie, what a point of information. She said, yes, very few people are told this. So you can actually have a conflict in a will if you say, under no circumstances are you to keep me on life support system because I want to go. On the other hand, if you want to be a donor, they're going to have to do that. This is a point that
yes.
I don't think many people are aware of.
Well, I think there are many aspects of this that people are not aware of because why would they be? They've never really had to consider it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great when somebody goes through this process, which we call life care planning, which is what your friend was doing, helping someone create an advance directive so that her wishes are known and her family knows her wishes and her care facility knows her wishes. That's very, very important. So you can still donate tissues even if you're not on life support. The eye tissue, the bone, other body tissues will be all right. It's the solid organs that have to still be perfused with blood and oxygen in order to be able to be used. But I want to emphasize that you're only on life support for a very brief time because, Donna, as you said, there's a short window of time in which the organs can be taken from the body and transported to wherever they are needed. So it's not like you're on life support for days and days and days. And when the doctor told me that Maya was brain dead and said he was signing a death certificate, he made it abundantly clear that we did not have time for much debate. We had to decide right now because she had been on life support for 4 days. And the longer a person is on life support, the less usable the organs become. And indeed, her lungs were not usable because of the ventilator. She had been on a ventilator for 4 days, and her lungs had filled with fluid, and it wasn't possible to use them. But her other organs were usable, and she was only kept on life support, which our donor coordinator explained to me at that point is no longer life support, it's organ support. You're not trying to keep the person alive because at that point Maya was dead, clinically speaking. It was only the machinery that was keeping her heart beating and her lungs pumping. So it's a very short period of time, and I think people who I'm in the same camp, I do not want to be kept artificially alive. On the other hand, I do want to be able to donate my organs and tissues if they are usable.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that I think people need to think very, very clearly about and have conversations about. Talk to medical professionals or social workers or family members, whoever they need to talk to get a good understanding of what is required if you do want to donate, especially organs.
Now, there's a couple of points. One of the things that you brought out in your book is that when they were doing this, when they were, you know, going through and removing the organs and working with the bones and the tissue and this type of thing, they found that her brain had been loaded with gangrene. So it's effectively done like an autopsy. They're very meticulous about what they do, and they related to you if you had any concerns about the reality of what was affecting her, that this had already metastasized in her brain to such an incredible degree. So there was a lot of information that came through, but let's now talk about the other side, because what we're discussing may sound a little gruesome to some people, but I really think that it's important to have clarity from your daughter's young, healthy body. There were a lot of aspects that were, or many parts of her that were utilized. You talked about how her heart, her liver, her lungs were not usable, but her heart went to a 54-year-old man from Chile. Her tissue and bone was being used for transplant, bone grafts, middle ear grafts, tendons, ligaments, cartilage, used for reconstruction following disfiguring injuries. Both of her corneas were given to somebody else. One had gone to a 39-year-old woman in San Francisco, another to a 66-year-old man from Alameda. They both regained their sight. And you were given this information. Now, you were not given the names of the people at the beginning, but you were told what went on, and you were very much involved at the time, started your involvement with the California Transplant Donor Network. And you got a letter, and in this letter it says, on behalf of the California Transplant Donor Network and all those whose lives have been changed by your compassionate and heroic decision, thank you. May thoughts of how you've helped so many others comfort you, and may you find peace in the days ahead. I think that that's a very powerful happening, to know that your daughter's death contributed to the well-being of so many individuals that you didn't even know anything about, including people out of the country.
Correct. Well, her heart recipient was a dual national, so he wasn't out of the country. He received his transplant at UCSF in San Francisco, and he lived in the United States at least 6 months a year. His children were largely educated in the United States, so that was a very unique situation. But, of course, when you say you are willing to donate, you don't know who is going to get your gift. And I only found out more details after the letter you described, in fact, some years later, because transplantation and donation is closed, just like adoption. The records are closed. Everything is anonymous, and you can only find out this information if both parties are willing, if both parties request it. And as it turned out, our heart recipient, Fernando, and I both requested within 2 days of each other, and this was 2 years after Maya's death, to be able to meet. So only 10% of donor families ever meet with their recipients. It's very rare. I need to emphasize that. For most people, it's so emotional. It's not something that is easy to do, but it is extremely uplifting. And I'm very glad that I reached out and that Fernando reached out at the same time, because I think it helped both of us a lot.
He had said to you when you had the opportunity to meet him, Fernando was just so grateful. He said, "You've given me a part of yourself. The child who lived in you is living in me. I have so much respect for what you have done." And his family was just so grateful, because his heart was so bad that he was literally non-functional. And here, your young daughter, her heart, which was good and strong, was given to him, and he was enabled to live for how long? 16 years? 14, 16
yes,
years?
Yes, he lived for another 16 years past the time of the transplant, and ultimately he succumbed to cancer, not heart disease. The heart was perfect throughout.
But I had to chuckle, because he said he could feel your daughter, that she would not let him sit still. And I had to chuckle about this. And he had said to you he saw the compatibility of two hearts as a sign of fate. This man really believed very strongly that this was a very special gift to him. And your daughter's heart was almost an exact tissue match with Fernando's diseased heart. The odds of that are really rare.
Yes. Yes, and I think Fernando, back at the beginning of this, you talked about soul force, and Fernando was very aware of that. He was very aware of Maya's soul and felt that Maya was communicating with him, that he had somehow combined forces with her in a way, and he started to do healing work with other people who were waiting for transplants, because he knew how difficult it was and how hard it was on their families. And so he would meet with them, share his story, try to give them hope. And at the same time, of course, I was trying to tell the story from the perspective of the donor family so that other people could understand what this actually means, how it affects people's lives, and how it can help the family recover from their grief. And I think a huge part of Swimming with Maya is focused on grief recovery and resilience, because as you said, again, at the beginning, everyone experiences loss in life, and loss is the ultimate spiritual test. Now, thankfully, not everyone experiences the loss of a child, but we all experience the loss of people that we love. And for me personally, this particular loss was a huge impetus to grow up spiritually and emotionally in a way that I had not done up until then. So it really caused a lot of transformation, a lot of soul searching in me. And thankfully, I was already very spiritually oriented, partly from my upbringing. My mother was a very devout and spiritual Catholic. I am not a Catholic at this point, but I had gotten into the New Thought movement. I was a member of the Church of Religious Science in Oakland, and my minister, Margaret Stortz, who is still my practitioner, was hugely helpful through all of this. And I really had to get down and grapple with God over this because I was furious. I thought God had made a terrible, terrible mistake. And I recount in the book the struggles that I went through to get to a place of finally accepting that this was not, quote-unquote, God's will, that God was sorrowing over this loss just as much, if not more, than I was. But that, as you said, Maya made some decisions that didn't work out well for her. And we have free will in this life. We get to decide. We get to make choices. God does not control our choices. God simply gives us strength, gives us inspiration, gives us the soul force to work through whatever the outcomes of our choices are.
You have really dedicated yourself to helping people because of what you've been through understand choices that are in front of them. Organ donation, obviously, is a very individual choice, and it's something that I respect. I've known families who have lost loved ones because the transplants were not available. Today, we're in a cycle where maybe that aspect won't have to be done because they're learning how to take healthy tissues and grow them into organs. And this is a science that's evolving actually quite rapidly. But still, that living tissue, that opportunity maybe to empower someone else to go on to have a life can make a great deal of difference. And your book, Swimming with Maya, really is very powerful because you have not only shared your vulnerabilities, your pain, but also those experiences that were very, very profound that, as you just said, awakened you to a part of yourself and a part of life that you otherwise perhaps would never have known. We can never speculate on these things, and I really think it's a waste of time to speculate. But there's sort of an acceptance, and that's something that eventually you were able to get through. And I think the power of your book, Swimming with Maya, A Mother's Story, is something that really involves so much, letting go, being aware of that you can't control everything. I don't care what anybody tells you. But life is to be lived, and every day is a very precious experience. Eleanor, you have a website, eleanorvincent.com, where you go into more information about donor situations, and you go into these details, give all kinds of information there. And this is something that people, if they're interested, they can explore. So your website is eleanorvincent.com. Eleanor, and it's E-L-E-A-N-O-R, like Eleanor Roosevelt, as you told me before we went on the air. Vincent, V-I-N-C-E-N-T, eleanorvincent.com. It's a fascinating read. It's emotional. It is very descriptive. But it's a journey that Eleanor has taken that, well, I think it's got a tremendous healing capacity to it. Swimming with Maya, A Mother's Story. Eleanor Vincent, thank you for being my guest today.
Oh, thank you, Donna. I really have enjoyed talking with you and your audience.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break, and we're going to be back in just a moment. More good things to share.
We see it every day. Courts overflowing with frivolous lawsuits. People losing all of their assets simply because they were unprepared. The best defense against unscrupulous predators and creditors is a good offense. At Corporate Direct, we use the latest legal tools to help our clients of all sizes and from all over the world create a strategy to protect what is theirs. Think asset protection is only for the wealthy? Think again. Our Cover Your Assets strategies and tools are very affordable and practical. Industry leader Corporate Direct is owned and operated by attorney and best-selling author Garrett Sutton. Give us a call at 1-800-600-1760 or go to CorporateDirect.com to see how we can tailor a CYA plan for you. That's CYA, Cover Your Assets, with Corporate Direct. 1-800-600-1760. That's 1-800-600-1760 for CorporateDirect.com.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
Hello and welcome back. This is Donna Sebo. Telephone lines are now open. That's right. If you'd like to chat with me, all you need to do is dial 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Tomorrow, we are going to be dancing in rhythm with the universe. Don't you just love that title? That is just absolutely marvelous. Barbara Miller is going to be my guest, dancing in rhythm with the universe. And she has a delightful way of communicating her own message. And then we're going to be talking about contagious optimism. Boy, I can remember a boss telling me once, "What is it with you, Donna? You always look at life as a glass half full instead of half empty. I don't know what to do with you." Well, anyway, is that a surprise? But I really believe that being optimistic is so important. It doesn't mean I walk around with my head in the clouds. No. But if you don't do that, then the result, the opposite, is just terrible. So we're going to be talking with on Wednesday about contagious optimism. David Mezepel is going to be my guest. Then on Thursday, we're going to be talking with Tom Moore and his brand new book called First Contact. Tom is sharing his actual experience with someone extraterrestrial. That's right. Okay. I'm not into woo-woo, but Tom is a very down-to-earth, practical guy. He's been on my show before, so we're going to get into this, find out what happened to him. And then ADD is a gift, not a disorder. How many times do people put labels on us because we don't conform to an established paradigm? Well, Brad Worsley is a man I met in New York. He was diagnosed with this. His son has this challenge, but he says it's not a challenge. It's not a disability. He said we just think differently. Well, we're going to find out how he has enabled himself to become a very successful person on multiple levels using ADD as an asset. That's right, not as something that works against you. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. Well, I wanted to share a story with you today about a gold nugget. Now, for those of you that have been regular listeners to my show, you know that Alaska has a very special spot in my heart. For so many years, I have traveled to that magnificent state. I love the people up there. They're rugged individualists, very independent, and often they have the entrepreneurial spirit that, well, it's very significant. When you think of the pioneers who founded the state, boy, they were just an amazing group of people. But what about a nugget that was found in 1903?
Mm-hmm.
At the time, it was considered the value, $3,285.90. Well, my goodness, the size of this nugget was so huge that who knows what it would be worth today. Maybe well over $3 million or whatever, you know, multiplied 10 times some. But this was what was called the Golden Vision of Anvil Creek. Now, there were Alaskans that knew about this nugget, but there was a story behind this discovery that was published in the Alaska Yukon Magazine in July of 1909. Now, it was found by the Pioneer Mining Company. There was a claim that was owned by a man named Rock, who died in 1900. Now, his widow had the ownership of the claim. She entered into a contract with Frank Grimm and Ike Powers, agreeing to give them a half interest in the claim if they would develop it. Now, this is how the story goes. There was a small ditch that was dug in the spring. I mean, you can't work up there. I know, I've known a number of people in gold mining up in Alaska. You only have about a three-month period where you can do the mining, because otherwise the earth is frozen. It gets so cold. Now, what they did, they started sluicing off the earth's surface, and they began one corner of the claim, and it was near a railroad track. And there was a guy by the name of Leif Spray. And Mrs. Powers came out to the claim one day, and she called Mr. Spray over. He was busy working. She said, "I want you to dig in this spot. I really wish you would dig right here." And he asked her why, and she said that the previous day in her home, she had been in town, she had this unique experience. She called it a vision. Now, this is what her vision told her. She saw herself standing on a depot platform of the Wild Goose Railroad. And that's exactly where she was standing when she was talking to Mr. Spray. A strange man appeared. The man walked out to the spot that she told Mr. Spray where she wanted him to dig. Turning on his heels with military precision and bearing, and he walked, the stranger in the vision, walked back to Mrs. Powers and asked her a question. "Did you notice where I stopped?" She said, "Yes." "Well, under my feet at that point is a large nugget, and when this nugget is found, it will prove to be the largest nugget ever found in Alaska." Then he vanished. Mr. Spray is standing there, shovel in hand, I'm sure, and just looking at her, and he said, "Well, the nugget may be there, I hope it is, but I'll have an awful hard time with my bosses if I spend my time picking down through the frozen clay. Why don't you just get Ike to dig for it?" Well, Mrs. Powers said, "They just laughed at me. I've already asked them. If I were a man, I'd get it. I just know it's there." Now, in 1901, Mrs. Rock sold half of her claim to Jimmy O'Brien. The claim became the property of Grimm, Powers, and O'Brien. During the summer of 1902, these new owners, well, they were doing the digging, but they were taking out a lot of gold. The following winter, O'Brien continued to work the claim. He said it was his intention to find Mrs. Powers' phantom nugget. He didn't find it. In 1903, the Powers family, there's quite a bit of sickness, and they needed money. They were anxious to sell. So the claim became the property of the Pioneer Mining Company. Now, they had the means So they started mining on a very large scale. Now, the Powers family, they ended up leaving Alaska, going to California, and a lot of people were there to say goodbye to them. Now, there were a few of these friends that had heard of Mrs. Powers' visions, and they asked her, and they were laughing at her when they asked her, if she was satisfied to go away and leave that nugget still sleeping in the cold, cold ground. Her response to them was, laugh all you like, but remember what I say. The nugget is going to turn up someday. Don't you forget it. Well, Mr. Spray, yes, he was still working mines. Mrs. Powers was gone. He happened to come in to Nome from the hills that he was working his gold mining efforts at, and he found everyone in town was absolutely thrilled. Nome, this is where this mining location was, had become famous again by producing the largest nugget from this gravelly earth that was in the Northland. When Spray came in, because everybody knew about Mrs. Powers and her story and her vision, they asked him if he had seen it. He said, seen what? I said, the nugget. It's as large as a loaf of bread, and it's worth more than $3,000. And you have to remember, in the early 1900s, $3,000 was a lot of money. Well, he found out. The nugget was found on the Anvil Creek Bench Claim. Because he had known Mrs. Powers personally. He had been the one that she had talked with. He wanted to find out exactly where the nugget had been dug. He went out to the creek, and one of the miners showed him. It was the exact spot Mrs. Powers had seen in her vision. During the previous winter, as an after point here, the partners had worked within 6 feet of the big nugget. One more day's work would have bought Grimm, O'Brien, and the Powers family fame and fortune. The closing words to this article, fate had decreed otherwise. Mrs. Powers' vision was 100% accurate. They hadn't dug deep enough. And one of the reasons I wanted to share that story, and it's a true story, this isn't make-believe. I wanted to share the story with you because within each and every one of us, there is a gold nugget called talent. And it is something sometimes we don't dig deep enough inside of ourselves for that gold nugget. And I thought, how many times do we have adversity? My guest today was dealing with something with the death of a member of family. And the gold nugget that she has discovered is one of caring, compassion, and awareness that life has so much more depth to it than she ever could have even fathomed. But more than that, she discovered a gold nugget within herself because she pulled up and out of herself her skills of communication, being able to reach people's lives in a fabulous way. You see, inside of you, there is a gold nugget. And it can be as big as an asteroid. But somehow or another, you have to dig down deep inside of yourself. You have to be willing to take a risk. You have to be willing to say to yourself, what else can I work at? What else can I do? What really makes me come alive whenever I speak of it? What is it that brings me joy? I was talking with a client just this past weekend, and this person is involved in work because they have to make a living, they have to pay the bills. But there is so much more to their life. And when they told me what they were going through and they were down in the mouth, and I was saying, wait a minute. Look at this as an opportunity to leverage skills, to be able to develop yourself in a way that allows you to get into this creative side of you that you yearn to nourish. Remember, wherever you are is part of the basis of experience for you to achieve your own greatness. like the mining story, you have to dig in. You have to be willing to go a little bit extra with yourself. Don't listen to the naysayers. Investigate this richness of who you are. It's down there, and you can dig it. You can dig for it, bring it to light, and others will stand in awe, thinking, oh, aren't you lucky? Luck had nothing to do with it. Just like in finding this gold nugget, they had to dig deep enough to get to it. So the same thing is with you as a person. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Too many people become victims of frivolous lawsuits and scammers simply because they were unprepared. At Corporate Direct, we use the latest legal tools to help our clients of all sizes create a strategy to protect what is theirs. Asset protection is not only for the wealthy. Our strategies and tools are very affordable and practical. Give us a call at 1-800-600-1760 or go to CorporateDirect.com to see how we can help you. That's 1-800-600-1760 for CorporateDirect.com.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance our physical needs with our busy schedules is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors, a bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. Amino Muscle Snack Time can be used anytime, anywhere, first thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. Weight loss, appetite control. Only top-of-the-line and no genetically modified ingredients are used, no caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone number to call into if you would like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight is 888-627-6008. In a Sebo household, we have typically, when I'm not on the road traveling, a big Sunday breakfast. This is something I really enjoy doing. I love to cook. And I like fixing pan-fried potatoes. Now, I don't know if that's something that you might include in your diet, but usually I make it with, you know, using potatoes and onions and sometimes red bell peppers and things like that, and just cooking the potatoes until they're nice and crisp using olive oil or even coconut oil, I like to have, because it doesn't add coconut flavor necessarily to the cooking. But, oh, it's really great, and it takes high heat very nicely. But I really enjoy using potatoes, and I thought, what else could I do? There's some, you know, I love spicy food. And I came across, I have a cookbook here that's called The Red Hot Chili Cookbook. And I know, even though it's summer, I think flavorful dishes, spicy dishes, just, well, they fit. If you want something different, this is so easy to make. And you can use any kind of potatoes that you want. I prefer russet. That's one of my favorite. But you could use, you know, a new potato. There's just any type. But what you want to do, you want to have about 14 ounces, which is about a pound, close to a pound of potatoes, of course. And you want to cut them in two cubes, not tiny, tiny cubes, but, you know, chunks. I call them man-sized chunks. And what you want to do with this recipe, and I'm going to give you the ingredients. In fact, let me give you the ingredients first. You're going to need about a pound of potatoes, your favorite kind, a tablespoon of olive oil. You're going to need two garlic cloves crushed, one hot red chili, and you want to deseed it and finally chop it or just buy them already that way, 2 to 3 large ripe tomatoes, and you want those roughly chopped, and a pinch of sweet smoked paprika. And then you're going to need a half a teaspoon of regular paprika, and if you have some saffron, take a pinch of that, and a teaspoon of dried wild oregano. And then you need to have on the side 2 tablespoons of olive oil, or you can have 1 olive oil and 1 tablespoon of chili oil. So you can mix it. And if you really like it spicy, then use nothing but chili oil. And then a little bit of sea salt and some pepper. Now, this is what's called a tapas dish. The Spanish people love this, and it's just got so much flavor. So this is what they recommend that you do. You take your potatoes, cut them into chunks, put them in a large saucepan of lightly salted boiling water, and let them cook. But you want the potatoes not so they're soft. You want them firm, but they're cooked through. And then you want to drain them, and then you want to maybe drain them after through a sieve, and then put the potatoes on a paper towel so that they're going to be dry when you start cooking them. Now, you're going to take a tablespoon of your olive oil, put it in a frying pan, and depending on how, if you're going to fix this for a crowd, you're going to use double the recipe. You could even double, triple this recipe. But I would say if it's just for this one, you're not going to want a real big pan, but I'd recommend a Teflon-coated pan because then you won't stick. You may need some extra oil if you use the cast iron skillet just to keep it from sticking. But a tablespoon of oil in a frying pan over medium heat. You put your garlic and your chili in for about a minute when it gets fragrant. You know that you want to add your tomatoes and cook those fresh tomatoes. They're going to break down. The juice is going to come out. Then you add your seasonings, your paprika, your saffron, and your oregano. You stir and cook it for about 5 to 10 minutes. The flavors are going to marry, and the tomatoes are going to be nice and soft. You remove it from the heat, and you're going to cover it. Then, with that done, you're going to need another frying pan, and you're going to need a larger one. Heating it over medium-high heat, put your other 2 tablespoons of oil in that, and your dried cubes of potato, you're then going to put them in there and fry them until they're golden brown and they're crispy. And then you take the sauce that you have made when you're ready to serve, and those potatoes are nice and crispy, you have the sauce, you go and you put that over your potatoes, serving it. And, of course, I love to add cheese to the top. I like to add some spicy cheese. Yes, it does have a kick to it, taste-wise, but, oh, it is so, so good. Simple, easy, flavorful. And if you want to serve this and you have children and they don't want the spice, you know, let's say you have people that just don't like spice, then you can eliminate the chilies. But what I would say is you could use a milder chili and a mild green chili that you could use instead. And it's going to be wonderful, but I like it hot. I really do. And I think it's just absolutely delicious. Goes great with scrambled eggs and fresh biscuits, and it's just a different kind of a dish. Donna Sebo here, and I know we've just got a little bit of time left, but so many times people wonder, what could I do with my life? What could I have in the way of a profession? Well, there is a woman here in Seattle. She works at Seattle's Aquarium. Her name is Katie Hart. She's an underwater gal. That's exactly what she is. She's a diver in the window at the Washington Waters exhibit at the entrance to Seattle's Aquarium. She said she's often the first thing that people see when they go into the aquarium here. She's from Erie, Pennsylvania, and she was so passionate about diving that she moved to Seattle and volunteered at the aquarium for 7 months. They saw her passion, and they hired her. She has the job of marine science interpreter, and she loves being down there with fish. How many of us would think of that as a job? And she said, I absolutely love this. I love being in Seattle. I love being in an environment where the outside world is just nothing but a huge aquarium. Of course, we have fabulous waters. And she said, I just absolutely love my job. Volunteering for 7 months, incredible. You can do the same thing in your own way. What is it you're passionate about? What is it that you feel that would make such a difference in your life? Maybe you need to take lessons in Zumba. I don't know. Try something different. This is your life. Make it an interesting one. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You the captain of your soul. This is Donna Sebo. God bless. Join me tomorrow, same time, same place. We'll be here talking about some fabulous things. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.